we are the first generation to completely understand the effects of anthropogenic climate change, and quite possibly could be the last generation to create effective change.
This is A New Angle, and I'm your host, Justin Angle, marketing professor at the University of Montana College of Business. This podcast is my chance to speak with cool people doing awesome things in and around the great state of Montana. We are proudly underwritten by First Security Bank and Blackfoot. Hey folks, welcome back, and thanks for tuning in. You might be surprised to see us in your feed on a Friday morning, but this is a special occasion. Conrad Anker is here. Conrad is a legendary mountaineer and leader in the outdoor community. For nearly 30 years, he led the North Face athlete team, and his resume of climbing achievements is largely unmatched, both in terms of difficulty and longevity. Conrad is also a mentor, a philanthropist, and an activist, all important passion areas for him that we talk about today. With the election underway, Conrad and his colleagues at Protect Our Winters and other environment-oriented organizations are upping the volume on the climate crisis. And Conrad's had a front-row seat to climate change through his many years traveling to wild landscapes significantly altered by warmer temperatures, more extreme weather, and many other factors. And Conrad is also a Montanan. He and his family live in Bozeman and are actively engaged in the environmental politics of our state. He wants people to vote, and he wants people to think about the climate when they do. It was a great honor to spend some time with Conrad Anker, and I'm excited for you to hear our conversation right now. Okay, so we're here today with Conrad Anker. Conrad, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Justin, and it's a real honor to be on your show.
Yeah, so this was a long time coming. I'm really excited. Before we get into so much to talk about, just want to check in. You know, how are you and your family doing? This is an interesting time, the run up to the election, COVID-19, all of that. How does this time find you and your family?
Well, thanks for asking. I'm here in Bozeman, Montana, and my wife Jenny and I are here. We were married coming up on 20 years ago, and we have three grown sons. The youngest graduated university this June, so that was my summit, so to say, of something I wanted to finish up with the boys in school. And so that was a real happy moment. But prior to that, we all were affected by COVID and the whereas in sort of the bigger sense, the economy, societal, and then sort of a reset of what's important in life. So
yeah.
That being said, I still have plenty of opportunity to enjoy Montana's wonderful public lands at a more a down-tuned COVID pace. So, you know, playing it even more safe so I don't burden the hospitals. But being here and having a chance to understand how connected we are as a community, as a state, as a region, as a nation, and as a planet.
Yeah, I would think, you know, COVID's had sort of, it's affecting all of us, but it's affecting us in different ways. I mean, you mentioned there, you know, probably some of the bigger travel sort of expedition style projects that have been off of the menu, but you're able to get out, you know, locally and in many of the great public lands and so forth in Montana. How has it sort of changed your or affected your conceptualization of risk and kind of what you're willing to do and not do under the circumstance?
Yeah, great question, Justin. So this is the first year in 15 months since 1988 that I haven't had the opportunity to travel to the Himalayas. And
wow.
Whether it's Nepal, Pakistan, India, or Tibet, having been in those, and it's a part of what I love being over there and the people that I'm with. And that type of expeditionary climbing is, it involves risk. You're out in the middle of nowhere and a rescue isn't easily accessible. But when COVID became part of our lives in the second week in March, there was quite a bit of conversation about, well, you shouldn't go out climbing, and if you do fall, then you'll be in the, you'll overburden the hospital. And so that was initially the case. And then we were hand sanitizing, and we're taking misting alcohol water solutions onto the handholds of the boulders and really kind of studying into that. And as the disease has progressed, we're now doing little different things. And kind of a A funny side note on that is a friend of mine is in the healthcare service, and when COVID first hit, it was like people were mailing all these pizzas up, and they had no patients because they weren't in the hospital. It wasn't that really tragic scene that was coming out of New York City in April, and just when it was flaring up, the COVID. And so now I went out climbing with him the other day, and he's like, yeah, we're like full on and we're working harder than we ever, and there's no pizzas.
Yeah, the pizza train has ended, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's all getting back on to work, so to say.
Yeah, it was a strange time here, March, April. I'm a pretty passionate backcountry skier, and me and my buddies were sort of thinking through those same calculations, like what is the appropriate amount of risk to be taking. I sort of felt like I don't really feel comfortable jumping in a car with a buddy, or some of these drives that involve stopovers in small towns in rural Montana that don't have the medical infrastructure. And as you mentioned, sort of a stress on the search and rescue function if you have an accident, and all of those things. I think it's interesting in that those thoughts were super salient in March and April when we had a fraction of the disease that we have in our community now. But it doesn't seem like folks are willing to kind of go back to that level of vigilance. And it's hard to do. It's hard to turn that on and off, but it feels like a time where we should be taking it maybe more seriously as a collective than we are.
Yeah, good point. And as of yesterday, Montana was third in the nation in per capita infections. So along with the Dakotas, we're right there. And this conversation, I don't hear it happening at within our community of outdoor enthusiasts. Like, oh, we should do something a little less. I mean, I'm not out pushing the boundaries of ability along those lines. But I also see that in looking at places of where they serve alcoholic libations, and people are they're in those places, and it's a different form of recreation, but the it's almost as if, well, COVID's now 6 months into it. If it hasn't come by, or I'm going to have it run, I'll get it and I'll come back stronger. So there's a little disconnect in that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we could spend a whole series of episodes in getting into this, but I was sort of baffled in some ways. I mean, restaurants and bars are important parts of the economy. I understand that. They also have a symbolic importance to community. But it also seemed a little baffling that much of the conversation was focused on restaurants and bars and not necessarily around schools and childcare and healthcare for folks that needed and other sort of what I would consider to be more essential services.
Yeah, 100%. And it's it was hard on a lot of businesses, restaurants. Many of them didn't reopen after the initial lockdown. But where we're at with the education system and our healthcare system is more of a priority.
And so right before we started recording, you had made the comment that this has been, with the lead up to the election, this has been probably the most politically engaged time of your life. One of the motivations for this conversation is the importance of the issue of climate to you, your work with Protect Our Winters. I want to talk all about climate, but having had such a long and prolific career in the mountains and in wild spaces, when did climate kind of arrive on your radar screen as something you started thinking about?
Probably the first inclination of heat and climate was probably where my grandmother and grandfather had a small restaurant and their place in Central California. My brother and sister are still there. Both my parents have passed away. But I remember sitting one time there and watching a car pull up at the top of the grade and was overheating, and it was just the radiator exploded and the car was just, and it was a common thing. It's a steep 2,000 foot elevation gain. It's just hard on vehicles. And then looking at the asphalt and the heat there. And I was like, every time one of these engines heats up, it warms up. And so that was kind of this understanding of warming when I was a teenager, but it came into being in the when I started mountain climbing and to go into alpine climbing and with trips to Alaska. So a lot of the research that you do prior to an expedition is looking previous expeditions to a range, where they climbed, what they'd done, and going all the way back to the Torresella in the 1890s, there's photographic record of climbing expeditions on the mountains. And so in seeing the change that places in Alaska, the Himalayas, the Karakoram, and routes that when they were established, they had a mass of ice on them, and then subsequently they were not climbable at all. And two specific mountains. One was the Ogre, which Doug Scott was famously rescued off with broken ankles and one of the greatest epic stories of survival. And the route that they climbed is no longer in existence. It's completely melted off, and there's recently exposed granite there, which is not optimal for climbing. And then the other one was Chulatse in the Khumbu Himal. And there, the Fearn Line, where the ablation of a glacier, where it accumulates above and it dissipates, melts below, had moved up 3,000 feet, 1,000 meters. And wow. Repeating a route that a Chulatse, which was climbed by Vern Clevenger, Galen Rowell, and John Ross Kelly. And we went to go climb it in 2005. And it was same sort of story that happened on the Ogre, that there the ice had just, it melted away, and there was a recently exposed rock on there. And in a similar way, looking at permanent snow fields here in Montana, one of the ways we can look at the stability of talus fields and how long rock has been exposed is the size of the lichen. And when you're in these mountain ranges, say in the Absorkeys, and you come across an area, and it's like, wow, that place had a permanent snow field up until recently, because right. Just on this aspect over here, there's centuries old lichen, and then here there's absolutely nothing, and that had a snowfield on it. So all these small indications that by dint of being passionate about climbing, I was seeing the changes in the mountains.
And what effect is that having on you? I mean, you're seeing some of it through your research, but as you mentioned before, whether it's, you know, in the Absorkeys or in Nepal or in Antarctica, like places you're traveling to again and again with longer intervals in between, like how is this sort of affecting your relationship to these landscapes and how you're thinking about them?
Well, I'm a mountaineer, so I'm the ears of the mountains. That's a silly joke. It's a pun.
Yeah.
A full dad worthy joke.
Well done.
Yeah. So we're the eyes and ears of the mountains. And climbing in the mountains, yeah, we'll be straight up. It's selfish, it's ego driven. It's not like we're becoming better scientists or doctors or computer technicians or anything like that. We're going up there for our own enjoyment, recreation, rejuvenation, and ideally towards one's self-actualization of like what you really want to do in, sure. in life. And so, yeah, climbing is great. It's fun, but it's giving us a measuring stick. We are the canary in the coal mine with climate change that's happening now. And whereas, yeah, if there might not be an ice route or the ice climbing season is shorter, and we'll adapt to it, we'll have fun. Yeah, but it's not like it's a major thing that a privileged white person like myself, male to boot, living in Montana, is like, oh, you don't get as many days skiing in there. Yeah.
Right.
Boo-hoo. But we are seeing climate change, and the people that are affected by it are the people that aren't necessarily causing the level of CO2 increase. So say for people in Bangladesh, the areas there that are affected by the typhoons and monsoons that come in and their quality of life. And so in places where there's seasonal flooding, or Houston, Texas, getting hit twice with a hurricane in one season, things like that, these are real tangible effects of what climate is. And if we experience it in our recreation, that's good, but it's still a very, there's the effects affect more people around the world than what we think. And disproportionately, lower income communities, communities of color. And so in that sense, there's a responsibility on our part to address this.
Absolutely. Have you, and I know it's been, you know, a year without a trip to the Himalaya, but knowing how important that community and the Sherpa are to you, has there been any effects within in those communities? Is it affecting their livelihood, their relationship to the land, and so forth?
Yeah, great question. So Jennifer and I have a close connection with the village of Fortse, which is in Nepal, and the site of the Kumbu Climbing Center, a vocational training program for high altitude workers in Nepal, and in working in conjunction with the Nepalis there. But in Nepal, there's not this societal question of, is climate change real? It's like, it's very real.
And yeah, it's happening.
Yeah. And Nepal is, by the current definition, a victim nation because they are not producing the CO2 per capita that's causing climate change. But like the people of the Maldives, the people of Nepal that are in the Himalayas, they are going to be suffering the effects of it. So, near-term prognosis is accelerated melting of glaciers. Those would then can release more water. If the water leaves the mountains in a normal fashion, things are well. But the opportunity or the risk of glacial lake outburst floods, so where previous terminal moraines that were there from the 1850s or 14,000 or 20,000 years ago, those then fill up with water. And then they're catastrophically released. So that would be an example of how in those areas. But there's also most human observation of climate is anecdotal. Oh, it was warmer then, or at Thanksgiving, it always did this. And they bring us a connection to it, but it's not climate and weather are connected. Weather is what's happening today. Climate is a long-term understanding of it. And for a lot of the people in the villages, they see these changes and there is a connection to atmospheric CO2. And so they're not in this debate as, well, 98% of scientists agree that climate change is anthropogenic climate change is real and that we need to address it. And 2% say no. And out of fairness of debate, we need to have that 2% get 50% of the conversation. Rather, they're like, climate change is real. What can we do on our part to help mitigate the challenges?
Yeah, it's interesting how it's sort of become such a politicized topic here in the U.S. I mean, some of the sort of foundational conservation-oriented pieces of legislation or policies can be attributable to Republicans in many ways. And, you know, I don't want to get necessarily too partisan about this conversation, but, you know, the conservation space in general has been an area, and particularly in this sort of unique form of purple that Montana occupies, it's been an area where left and right can kind of come together and share some common objectives for how to be better stewards of the land. Talk about your perspective on that, particularly here in Montana.
Yeah, so Theodore Roosevelt was given a large credit, large amount of credit for the creation of the national park system, and then his deep belief in the rugged life and getting outdoors and the benefits of that. And then under President Nixon, we had the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act. So both of those are instances where people are with that. And Montana is interesting, maybe unique, but maybe not, in that voters here, our access to public lands and the quality of life that brought us to Montana and that keeps us here is of great importance. And so the for many of the citizens of Montana, public lands is their single issue voting. I encourage people not to be single issue voters about any one thing and to be look at it from a holistic and from everything that's in their civil rights to economic opportunity and how we treat people, and then including that in the environment. But that within Montana, that outdoors is such a part of our fabric that it spills over into the political process.
You know, and it strikes me, you know, I just watched a few days ago a new film by one of your Protect Our Winters colleagues, Jeremy Jones, Purple Mountains, which sort of takes a really courageous attempt to have hard conversations with people that you might not ordinarily agree on much, but maybe you can come together on understanding the importance of these natural spaces. You know, there's kind of a quote in the opening of that film that kind of references something you said earlier about climbing being essentially a bit of a selfish pursuit and a bit of a luxury. You know, that, hey, you get to sort of play in the mountains while I have to do hard, real work. I mean, there's people out there that sort of claim, well, I just, you know, all I can do is kind of work and put food on the table and provide for my family. I don't have time to really think about the climate. Whereas for you, it's kind of a luxury to be able to think about it because you're in this privileged position of being a professional adventurer or a recreator or whatever. How do you kind of think about those tensions in a way that we can maybe make progress in these sorts of conversations?
Yeah, and great effort on Jeremy and Purple Mountain and the film that they brought together there and creating that dialogue. And yeah, and one of the most common darts that's launched at me in social media is that, yeah, what do you know? You're a person of privilege and you get to play in the mountains all the time. And so it's the, I work as a guide, I work in media, I work in product development. So it's kind of a piecing together a variety of different ways of earning a living. But it certainly feels like work day in and day out. And
sure.
Having, I love carpentry, I love working in the woods and a lot of these things. So it's not there. So, but at some point we all, regardless of our economic station in life, we recreate because it brings joy to us, and that it can be unloading a clip with your AR Bushmaster at the target range. It can be practicing your piano. It can be writing poetry. It can be stamp collecting, trail running, mountain bike, whatever. We do things that bring us life. And so accepting people in prison, pretty much everyone has some moment in their life where they're not working and they're doing something that brings them happiness. And if that happiness happens to connect to the environment, then you're more aware of it. At the end of the day, we all recreate in one form or the other. And when your recreation is connected to climate and thermoregulation, you're more aware of the natural world.
Yeah, that makes good sense. And it kind of makes me think about, you know, Montana's in this interesting space. Gosh, I mean, we should also mention that, you know, we're recording this on October 13th. October 12th is Indigenous Peoples Day. And, you know, the sort of history of the white man's relationship to the land here is fraught in many ways. And then you layer on top of that this notion of, you know, Montana's history as a state built on an extraction economy, now maybe transitioning to a state sort of built more on a tourism economy. You know, when you think about climate and conservation, environmental activism, I mean, one of the tools you can use to bring people into understanding the importance of these issues is getting them out there in wild spaces. Yet getting more people out in wild spaces puts more stress on the resource. And so there's this balancing act. And then it's sort of a conversation about privilege. Well, just because I've been recreating in this space my whole life doesn't mean it's any more mine than somebody that's never been here before and wants to check it out and come to the party as well. And how do you kind of think about those trade-offs with regard to, you know, getting this message about the importance of climate out there, but also being mindful of the impacts that getting more people out will have?
Yeah, there's the responsible hashtagging movement and all this and that. But I promote climbing. That's what my job is, and I get that. So I'm either guilty or of doing something wrong, or I'm happy that I've encouraged more people to get outdoors. And being outdoors is good for humans. It's good for our soul. It's a great way to recuperate. And just being on a trail and being out of our oversubscribed plastic, steel, glass, rectilineal concrete world, we get to be in nature, and we come back rejuvenated. And whenever I see someone out recreating, I smile and I say hello to them. Yeah, we're fortunate in Montana. I've never had an overcrowded climbing experience. So it's always been a fewer people, but it's also self-selecting in that I know areas where there might not be as many people, and I can adjust my recreation. It's not, say, like Clear Creek Canyon in the Front Range of Colorado, in between, just outside of Golden, where you have a huge major urban area and easily accessible, well-protected sport climbing. And there you see people queuing up for climbs and dogs and music and all of this. And that's fine. I'm glad people are out there having a good time. So, and, you know, this is like, oh, you're ruining my experience. But I think now after COVID, we realize that connecting with other people is part of the human experience too.
A New Angle is brought to you by First Security Bank and Blackfoot, two cool companies doing awesome things all over Montana.
I'm Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, and you're listening to A New Angle.
Whether you were to go to a concert or a stadium game, being in that space with those other humans is an affirmation of your being and your humanity. And in that same sense, if we look at seeing other people outdoors, that they affirm our presence on this planet.
Yeah, that connection with other people is such an important thread, and seems like it's been such an important thread in your life as well. Some of these just high profile expedition experiences you've had, those are really where deep relationships and friendships and trust are forged through some shared suffering. Maybe talk about that a little bit. How have you come to connect with other people more deeply through your experiences in these wild places?
Being outdoors is participatory. So if we go outside for our walk this afternoon or your run, you're doing it yourself. You're not plugging into the media machine to watch a basketball game, which I enjoy watching, and I love sports. But it's about going out and doing that experience. And so if Justin, you and I were to climb together, and hopefully get a chance to do that one of these days, that when we tie into the rope, we are a team. And our adversary is, number one, gravity. Number two, the cliff that we're climbing on, the feature of the rock, the type of rock. And we have the weather to layer on there. And throughout all of this, we have this connection that you're belaying me, your trust of me is what I need to enjoy nature. And so that connection that you have to trust another person in the outdoor space is priceless. And that is one of the good messages in that why people, when there is challenges, where there are ways that are difficult, that they seek solace in the outdoors. And we'll use Camp David as an example outside of Washington, D.C., where here we have a retreat that the president could bring world leaders in that didn't have the structure and the authority of Washington, D.C. and the regulation and all of that, but rather it was outdoors. And you can imagine them having a campfire and s'mores and then going for a walk in the deciduous hardwood forest there and talking about Mideast peace and doing those things. And that even something as simple as walking outdoors, you're watching out for the person you're there. I mean, there could be a bear that jumps out of the trees or something like that, or a tree could fall down. There is some bit of risk that makes you connect to that other human. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, as you lay that out there, you know, I often sort of say when I'm heading out for a run, you know, my kids will say, well, where are you going? What are you doing, Dad? And I'll say, well, I'm going to solve the world's problems. And, you know, your example is quite literal. Like, you can bring together people in an outdoor setting where you strip away so much of that unnecessary formality. And you realize that, hey, we're people and we have common goals and common things that we can sort of work toward. Yeah, that's hugely impactful. You know, something you said in there, you talked a little bit about risk, and that's something I've wanted to ask you for a while is, you know, this relationship to risk and how it's sort of, it's got to be part of the attraction in some ways to climbing. But you're doing this with other people and you've sort of confronted risk on so many levels. It's kind of a constant. You've also had loss of your mentors, of peers, of people you've been a mentor to. Like, how do you kind of grapple with the concept of risk, both in the moment and then over the arc of a lifetime in the wilderness?
Yeah, great question. So, we go climbing, and it's obviously we're putting ourselves in a more dangerous place. I mean, we could minimize all the risk and not go outdoors, but being outdoors where you have to perform. So if you make a mistake climbing, gravity doesn't, there's no, you don't get a boogie shot or whatever, a bogey shot, and a makeover. It's like, no, gravity is going to just accelerate till you land at the bottom of the mountain and you're dead. And so, yeah, I've become far too much of that. As you mentioned, my mentors, yeah. My peers and the people that I've, my mentees and all of that is in there that I've lost that. And there's danger, which is a threat to our existence. So identifying danger, and then we evaluate that to see what the risk is. What is the risk of that danger event happening to an individual? And for myself, my factory setting at birth was hyperactive, wired,
sure,
ADHD, just, you know, it was crazy. Second grade was a challenge trying to like, all this data's come streaming into my mind, and I didn't have a to-do list, or I hadn't been outdoors. And so my parents were like, okay, no medication, more time outdoors, less sugar. That was their,
yeah, just run this guy hot. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Go outdoors until you're so tired that you lay down. So that was, and I'm thankful for them because it set me on the right path. And it was rather than a pharmacological solution to a child's hyperactive,
indeed,
it was getting outdoors. And that trait of being hyper situationally aware is what has kept me alive in the mountains. So all that data that was screaming for my attention, now when I'm outdoors, I'm listening to the snowpack. I'm observing the snowpack. I'm making a decision whether I will ski that run, given the amount of data that I have in there. And so the same thing applies when you're climbing, that all of a sudden, when you're on a rock climb and how do I hold on to that handhold for optimum and not fall off? Then the rest of this stuff we call life, your mortgage payment that's due on the 5th of each month and COVID crisis, all that, it's like, it's gone. You are living in the moment.
Matter.
And in that sense, it's sort of this active meditation that gives us somewhere to go in life.
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, that's part of the attraction in many ways, like these situations we put ourselves in force us to strip away all that stuff and focus on the moment and nothing else. Yet at the same time, it's sometimes hard to crowd out all that noise. I would suppose, you know, I've never done an expedition, anything like the scale of the expeditions that have been a big part of your life. I mean, there's probably a process of getting into that headspace. Probably takes certainly a lot more than a day to get there. You know, what's that kind of process like for you of gearing up, you know, leaving the family, getting into that proper headspace to confront that level of risk and make good decisions and then come back to the other part of life?
Yeah. An expedition is kind of a full circle. You'll start out with the idea of it, then you have the planning, and then the preparation, the equipment, and then you travel, you go do it. And sort of the halfway point of that circle is when you make it to the summit or you make the decision to return home, and then the circle comes back. And so when you walk back into your house and see your family again, you've closed that circle. And so you have to make sure on all these expeditions that you close that circle. And the tremendous amount of gratitude and respect and love for my spouse, Jennifer, over the 19 years that we've been married and 18 years she was married to Alex Lowe, that understanding of going outdoors and doing what we do and the risk within that, and that is a tremendous amount of gratitude and thankfulness for Jennifer and her understanding that. And may all of our spouses be as supportive of our loved ones' goals and aspirations as she has been for mine. But when you're on expedition, you go from sort of this a community-based thing. So here I am. I wake up. It's Bozeman, Montana. There's 50,000 people here, 90,000 in the three counties area. And everyone's getting out, doing their life. I might interact with someone at the store. I'll check in with my training partners. I'll go out and exercise. But when you're on expedition and it's just six of you, your life becomes those five other people. So you're tuned in as they're tuned into you. Is your friend dehydrated? Are you feeling cold? Do we need to have more food? And you're kind of watching over each other. And that playing fort, that togetherness is really, that's the communication and the happiness that means so much to me, is coming away from these expeditions with this deeper friendship with your friends.
Yeah, that was so well captured in the Meru film. What was that, 2015 the film came out? Something around there. But I thought, you know, I'm sort of a junkie for these types of films. And the team camaraderie and the depth of those relationships, seemed like that film captured it better than I shouldn't say better, because it's not a competition, but in a much more authentic way than I'd seen it captured before.
Yeah, it wasn't about the numbers. It was about three individuals working together towards a common goal and the trials and tribulations that each of us had gone through. So there was, and thanks to Jimmy and Renan for capturing the film while we were on the mountain in 2011, and to Chai and Jimmy for editing and bringing that film to where it is.
And so speaking of films, I kind of dig into this. I know that... Alex and Jennifer's son, Max, your adopted son, Max, is working on a film called Torn, which is largely an exploration of your family's arc. What's the state of play with that film? Last I heard it was sort of in post-production. Can you tell us anything about it?
Yeah, so Max Lowe, our oldest boy, is, he's 32 now, so he's a young man.
He's launched.
He's a taxpaying citizen in the United States. I can proudly say that. So, but his film is about our story with our life and Alex Lowe and what it was like being there. And so coming to a lot of these questions with it. And it is set to release next year around September.
Okay.
So it was finished. It was supposed to come out this September, but due to COVID and not having theaters, it's a film working in partnership with National Geographic. So they were like, we'll wait. And rather than just putting it straight to the digital streaming services, we're going to see where the theaters are. So, which is good. And it's been a wonderful process to do it as a family and to understand our, what's unique to us and our challenges. And hopefully people will be able to, afterwards, be like, oh, that was kind of a neat thing. I learned from it. And there was a small takeaway.
Yeah. And it has to be such an amazing kind of experience for you, being such a part of the story, but also this moment for Max coming into this sort of directorial debut on the, hopefully as it plays out on the big screen. That's also got to be a great moment of pride for you and your wife as well.
Yeah. It's a good thing. And storytelling via the film is such a rich medium. And you can, in an hour and a half, you can tell so much. So there's really we're happy for them.
Well, super. So let's shift gears back to climate a little bit. I want to just call out more explicitly Protect Our Winters, an organization that you're affiliated with. There are so many groups doing important work with climate, with the environment. How did Protect Our Winters arrive on your radar screen, and why did you make the choice to affiliate with this great organization?
Yeah, Jeremy founded it, I believe, 2007. So, and then 2011, he invited me to be on the board. We went and climbed Denali together, and so we'd been friends and acquaintances, and so. But it's been a wonderful opportunity and great organization to see it grow to where it is. A wonderful group of colleagues that I'm on the board of directors with that really make it worthwhile. And the beautiful part of this is that we are able to communicate with the 18 to 30 year old outdoor recreation person that is, they're passionate about being outdoors, whether it's trail running, skiing, hiking, being outdoors is their reason of living and comes back to why we live in Montana, that same conversation a little bit earlier. And with Protect Our Winters, we're showing this group of people that are outdoor enthusiasts, here's the science, this is what climate change is, these are some experts that can help you talk about it, and we're encouraging them to talk about it. We're giving them permission to talk about it. We're giving them the responsibility to talk about it. And we're giving them the tools to talk about it. And that whole process of civic engagement has been, it's been a lot of fun to see how it's grown, and that there's Protect Our Winters chapters that have sprouted up, volunteer chapters in Europe and in Asia just on their own, because people are like, this message resonates with sure. our community. We want to help out. And so there's, I think the more voices that team together that are climate aware, then the better off we are. And Greta Thunberg and her work in the last couple of years as a young person has been great to see that for children, young adults of that age to be like, wow, here's some that I can do this too. And they're dedicated to it. And it's not something that's abstract. This is something that's going to affect the future of these young people's lives.
Yeah. How would you advise people hearing this, or just people in general who sort of feel compelled to maybe want to try to get involved in this space? I mean, what first step should people take?
The initial step is living a purposeful life. So doing what you can to minimize your travel, being mindful of the type of food you consume and its impact on the planet, and doing the best you can, recycling. And we get that, and we're moving towards that. But the way our economy functions and the market externalities that are beneficial and detrimental to both the carbon industry and the renewable industry are the result of legislative action. So to get the ball moving and to get the flywheel of innovation underfoot and to get ideas going, we need market externalities that support renewable energy and climate awareness. And the only way we can work that out is through the ballot box. I mean, we are a democracy. And so having leaders that identify these as an existential threat to humanity, both in the near term, and I'll use near term as 40 years, in the long term as in 200 years, having those type of elected officials will help us sustain the health of this planet. And it's where we are now is it's not about, oh, save the planet or anything like this. We have to save the planet so we can save humanity, and finding that balance between a carbon intensive lifestyle, which we all live and we're all guilty of and we're all living the benefit, and to make that transition to a less impactful lifestyle. And so, and that whole transition is happening as we speak. And we, as the saying is, we are the first generation to completely understand the effects of anthropogenic climate change, and quite possibly could be the last generation to create effective change. So every day we dilly-dally here in 2020, the effect in 40 years would be a lot more profound. And so the way I look at this from a climber standpoint, a metaphor analogy, if we will, and it's like, well, yeah, I always get up early and I'm like, get going earlier than everyone says, oh, we're going to start at 3. I'm like, well, let's start at 2.
Exactly.
It drives my climbing partners nuts, but they all know that's my MO. And
yep.
Because 15 minutes in the morning at the dark can be an hour in the evening when you're tired and late, and getting ahead of things like that. So that preparedness is something that we need to bring into a societal perspective.
Yeah, you know, we had on the podcast several months ago, Rob Davies, and I don't know if you know Rob, but he's a professor at Utah State, physicist by training, but also a really powerful climate communicator. And he was so hopeful in our conversation. And I asked him why he was hopeful. And he said, well, I'm hopeful because, you know, to use a climbing metaphor, we really haven't even roped up yet. We haven't really even started to take this problem, this challenge seriously. You know, in his view, the solutions are not necessarily obvious, but there are some very actionable ones. How would you, one of the things I think is a big challenge in this day and age is information, how to get good information, how to make sure that information that's coming at you is of high quality and not just sort of part of your individual filter bubble. What do you look for information, and how do you make choices about what information is credible or not?
Yeah. So if you haven't watched The Social Dilemma, a film by Jeff Orlowski, it's on Netflix. I recommend you take 40 minutes or an hour out of your life and watch that, and you'll learn about this nascent technology, social media, handheld computers. And it's only 12, 15 years old, and we really don't know how that is.
Yeah.
We're seeing some of the effects, and that film is eye-awakening. And I, Justin, I'm not sure how old your children are, but it's, as a parent, it's certainly something. And we have watched it as our family, and all of us have made changes to our how we consume social media. And so there's a lot of so there's that. So imagine we have this handheld microcomputer in our. I mean, there's more processing power in a modern cell phone than there was what we landed Apollo 11. So always when you keep that in mind, you're like, oh, it's got a lot of power in there. And I can open it up. I can go to Google Earth and I can look at a picture of the mountain range and see if I want to go there. I can find, I have a dictionary instantly at my hand. I have a dictaphone. So I can, I mean, there's all these wonderful things that do a great job with it. And the challenge within, once we get into social media, and both the two dominant properties, Facebook and Instagram, are owned by Facebook and under the control of Mark Zuckerberg. And there's Twitter and there's a few other ones, but it's basically three of these large powerhouses. TikTok is happening at a younger age, and I still haven't signed up or I know what's going on there. But when you have these, you have a algorithms, as one of the commentators in The Social Dilemma noted, they're opinions that are put into a mathematical equation. So the more that you go down a certain trail, say climate change, the more climate change information your phone will be delivering to you. And when I was a child, there was three television channels, and the news came on at 5 o'clock for national and 5:30 for local. And if you missed the news, then you missed the news.
And that was it.
Newspapers yep. came, and there wasn't this, oh, I'm going to go on demand and I'm going to find it and sort of click through it, or go onto YouTube, which is an algorithm driven TV type thing. And so there's, but to maintain impartiality, I try to have as many, as much input as I can in as far as my news. So a subscription to, say, either the New York Times or the Washington Post, one of the reputable national newspapers that still has a robust reporting staff and is doing investigative reporting
Right.
Our PBS television, the McNeil Lehrer News Hour with Judy Woodruff, that is my television news. I trust them. And same thing with public radio here in throughout the nation, but particularly in Montana. And there's no, when I listen to public radio, I can trust them getting an unbiased, I mean, some people think that public radio and PBS is sort of like, it's like this secret plot from Fidel Castro coming from the grave to like make us un-American. But
yeah,
I go with them as being reputable, and I can trust with them. And they also, in say our the Native American news, that all of the public radio stations in Montana, that they have that segment on there, that they're giving voice to groups that might not necessarily have a regular place in the commercial driven media.
Yeah, I think that's well put. And, you know, the sort of punchline to me is seek out diverse sources of information that are reputable, and understanding that a lot of what we end up seeing is driven by an algorithm, maybe make choices that try to break that algorithm, right? That sort of give you alternatives to things that just sort of can confirm your existing worldview. Conrad, this has been fantastic. I want to be respectful of your time. You have a lot going on your plate today, but I do want to call attention to an event you have coming up on the 19th of October, Send the State. This is a Protect Our Winters event. Can you tell us a little bit about it? What's going to be happening?
Yeah, I'll be joining Max Lowe, our oldest son, and we'll be doing a video conference slideshow kind of call, something like that. And it'll be neat. We'll have a conversation. As a parent, I'm a month away from being 58. Max just turned 32. And the where we're at and why it's important. And so there's it's great to see that. And it's, I guess for Jenny and I, one of the happiest things is that it makes us that we've done a good job parenting. And there's no one right way or wrong way, was that our children are civically minded and they're engaged and that they want to vote and they realize what's at stake. And that's a really good thing. And hopefully we'll share some of that in our presentation.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to that. We encourage listeners to get out there and check it out and check out Protect Our Winters. And above all else, get out there and vote. Voting is underway. I filled out my absentee ballot this morning, and I encourage everybody to do the same or go to the polls or all of the above. Conrad, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed learning more about your worldview, your approach to life, and great thanks for spending some time with us today.
And thank you, Justin. And even though we're 3 hours and 15 minutes away from each other, from Missoula to Bozeman, we're in the same state, and I can't wait to meet up with you and go for a trail run. And may the anxiety of the where we are right now in 2020 and the stress that a global pandemic has created, let's collectively use this as a way to look at life through a purpose-driven perspective of what is important to us and how we interact with our fellow humans. And that's, whenever there's something challenging or difficult, there's a lesson in there. We just have to be open to understanding it and seeing it and listening to it.
Absolutely. That's well put. Thank you, Conrad.
Justin, thank you. And thanks, listeners, for tuning in and for an hour of your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to A New Angle. A New Angle is underwritten by First Security Bank and Blackfoot, with support from the University of Montana College of Business and Consolidated Electrical Distributors. AJ Williams is our producer. Jeff Ament, John Wicks, and VTO made our music. And Jeff Meese is our master of all things sound. If you have any questions, suggestions, comments, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. If you like what you heard, tell your friends about us. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.